The following is intended for mature audiences. It includes references to the use of illicit substances as well as crude humor. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, America and France, turns out. I'm Zach Nanimous.
I'm Johnny Dim.
And I am Miltos Girolamo, also known as Sirio Forel, the first sword of Bravos.
Yes, sir, and you just tuned into the War Pod. Tonight, we are going to be talking about Dark Continents, Star Wars 7, The Art of Fencing, Miltos' personal projects, Space City Con, Batman the Killing Joke as an animated feature, Ash versus the Evil Dead, and we're also going to give our top three / bottom three fight scenes of all time! But first, as always, when we have a very, very, very special guest on the show, the first thing that we talk about is them. So, Miltos, how you doing?
Hi, I'm doing okay. I'm doing very well. It's at 10 o'clock at night in Aix-en-Provence, in the south of France, and the fan is going, there is no AC, and it's 40 degrees centigrade here.
Wow. Is that unseasonably hot for the south of France?
It's particularly hot here. We're having a heat wave.
Wow.
And I'm doing an open air performance of an opera. It's in this kind of majestic kind of medieval courtyard, which has been completely overhauled and turned into a theatre venue. But it is, for all intents and purposes, in the outdoors. And we perform at 9:30 at night. And the opera is about 3 hours long, so no one goes home before 2 o'clock in the morning. And even at 9:30 at night, when I begin the physical assault course training, which is my performance in this show, it's really hot. It's really bad.
So it's an opera, so you're speaking Italian the entire time?
No, it's Benjamin Britten's Midsummer Night's Dream, so it's all in English, and I'm playing Puck, and the role of Puck is all has been written as a, it's written just for a, it's just written for a voice, so, but it's all in tempo, so it's kind of very musical, even though it's not sung.
Okay, very cool. Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that your being in France might be the reason that it's so warm?
Oh, I see what you did there.
That is one of many awful jokes that you'll hear throughout this entire show.
It's actually our je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, I guess so.
My favorite French saying, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. Do you know what it means, Johnny?
No, I don't.
It means, I don't know what.
It really does.
I think if I had a vote, I'd go with deja vu.
So, how often do you find yourself walking the planks in live performances like this? Because, you know, we always hear about what you're doing in the cinema, particularly the American cinema. So, what are the other live theater projects that you've been working on lately?
Well, I the thing that has kind of taken up quite a lot, this is the weirdest thing of all. I feel like I have been doing A Midsummer Night's Dream by William Shakespeare for at least all of my life. I have been doing it for the last 4 years, like back to back. So I did it was last year, so basically 2 years ago I began working with Handspring Theatre Company, who did War Horse, which is a huge hit on the Broadway stage, with amazing puppetry in it. And these guys, they did the production of Midsummer Night's Dream, the same creative team who made War Horse. And we took that show all over the world. We took it all over the USA. We did Boston, Washington. We did even Utah, LA. We took it everywhere. And we I played bottom in that, and that was a really exciting production and something I was very proud of. And literally after that, I am now working doing the opera version of Midsummer Night's Dream, playing Puck. This is a 25-year anniversary of this production. It was such a success when they did it in 1991 that it has been revived year after year all over the world. And it's basically, we're doing it again 25 years later in its birthplace. It started in Aix-en-Provence at this opera festival, very prestigious, opera festival. And we've brought it back. And tomorrow we're going to be live screening it all over France.
They'll be recording you and while you're doing it, and it'll be broadcast out live.
Yeah.
Nice. Is it going to be online? Do you know?
It will be online. I am doing my best to try and find out where and how. They're trying to get in touch, let me know. But I don't know exactly who it will be. I'll let you know. But it will be. And we've also recorded it for a new DVD version of it. So, you know, it's nice to do something. Usually live performances are something that kind of happen and either you're there or you're not there, and then they just disappear or just kind of become a memory. But it's nice sometimes when you record something, especially something which is it's a fantastic production. It was a real game changer when it was created, because up until this time, really opera was considered full of very overweight people who really didn't know how to act, but could sing the pants off anyone else in the world. But Robert Carson and his production, amongst others, there's also Peter Sellers, who is an exceptional opera director. These people were real game changers. They made actors, opera singers act. They made them throw themselves around the stage. They made them fight each other. They gave them physical challenges to do and still hit those notes and hold those harmonies and kind of made everyone realize that opera actually could be a very exciting, dynamic medium.
And expensive as far as insurance is concerned, it sounds.
Oh, yeah. That's why the tickets are so expensive.
There you go.
Now, I actually did theater in college and some local theater. And the thing that I always hesitate to do musicals because I always get so sick whenever I'm in a show. Have you had any encounters with the show cred?
I don't get sick when I do. Well, having said that, anything could happen. I have this gnarly piece of wood that my dog brought in, which I'm now touching for superstitious. I haven't actually. I'm notorious for always injuring myself around the house. So when I'm like just wandering from one room to the other, I can quite easily catch my little toe on a door that's slightly ajar and kind of break it, but I've been really lucky that I don't injure myself when I'm working. I always do it when I'm off.
Considering that your job has a tendency to be so physical, especially since Game of Thrones, and everybody now knows that you have a fencing background, and so everybody's like, let's get Miltos. He knows how to stab people. He doesn't bleed. He's immortal.
So the whole thing about the fencing is an interesting thing as far as I'm concerned, because as far as the breakdown that was sent from the casting directors, Nina Gold, when they were casting the first season of Game of Thrones, when they were looking for someone to play Syria Farrell, they actually specified they wanted someone who had sword fighting experience to a high level. Now, unless you're a sportsman, you're kind of asking someone whether they are a rakish kind of gentleman who wanders the streets with a blade, a scabbard, you know.
Which, by the way, I considered because it's technically a piece of sports equipment. So,
yeah.
I thought, you know, we have open carry here in Texas where you can
Do you?
literally wear, yeah, you can literally wear a gun on your hip. So I thought, why not a sword on my back? I
Well,
had
that's all very well and good for
that.
Texas, but in the UK, you would get yourself arrested and put in a prison cell.
That all depends on how dashing you are.
Maybe that may be
Because
the case.
the police don't have firearms either, so it would be a melee fight.
Yeah, you're right. I'd love to try and see whether that stands up in court. I might give it a go. I'll let you know when I get one telephone call. It'll be like to you going, "It didn't work, guys."
Now bail me out.
Time.
My love, if you take a look at the CCTV evidence, you can clearly see that I won the duel and thusly am exonerated.
But going back to my experience with a sword,
Yes.
I just had a natural aptitude for it. It was something that I did at drama school. It's something that I did a lot of when I worked at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and I had a natural aptitude for it. I also was a dancer. I am a dancer, and so learning choreography, which is kind of part of learning sword fighting, for the stage or for TV and film, is a requisite. Some people can pick it up very quickly, and I can certainly do that. And Maisie could as well, because she's a dancer as well. So I think that kind of stood us in good stead. But I mean, all my experience has come since working with Bill Hobbs on Game of Thrones,
Yes.
and then basically doing my workshops, because as I've been doing the workshops at the conventions that I do, I've been, doing more research. I've been kind of honing them. I've been, at first it was just like, I'm going to do some water dancing and I'm going to teach you some stuff that I learned, filming. Now it's I have this whole thing where I ask the participants to look at the difference between what it would be like to choreograph a fight for the TV and the screen, and what the reality of dueling would actually be.
That's really cool. What separations do you see between the two arts, as far as realistic fencing for competition versus realistic fencing for trying to save your life versus being on screen?
So I think the ones between competition and being on screen, the differences between those is that what I see is that the guys that do like LARPing, what they what and I'm really impressed, because I've seen some amazing guys who really know how to use a sword. They get dressed up in the armor, they get dressed up, whatever they need to protect their bodies. And they know, because they've been fighting each other for a long time. They know each other's style, and they hold back their blows. So of course they don't cut off their fingers and they don't take out eyes, but they make contact, and it's improvised. They have a series of vocabulary, and they know what will happen if someone comes at you. High right, everyone, they just do it so often, and it's very close, and it's very messy, and it's exciting. And I would say that is the difference. Choreographed sword fighting or sword play for TV and film, of course, is incredibly choreographed. They need to know where the camera is going to be, they need to know how they're going to shoot it, and sometimes you have the actors doing it. Invariably, most of the time, it's always stunt people doing it. It's very clear. You can tell when an actor is actually doing the sword fighting and when they're not. But invariably, it's always sword, trained stunt people doing it. But and the difference between the TV stuff and the reality, of course, is that it's very flamboyant on TV. You want to see the fight. You want to see some kind of sword play. You want to see the combatants actually working hard, and you want to see how what their technique is. The reality, of course, is that in reality, in a normal duel, you would be trying very hard to make sure that the first blow was the last blow that you ever made. And so the reality of a duel is that it would be over very, very quickly. It would also mean that the longer a fight went on, the greater the chance, the likelihood that both combatants would end up dead from cuts and bleeding out.
From the nicks here and nicks there.
Because that, you just cannot avoid that when you're, you know, when you're swinging swords at each other. You know, with intent, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Intent, it's really hard. And you have to make such a commitment to each move, each blow, that, you know, it's really hard to avoid getting caught in one way or another. Game of Thrones is very good like that. You have seen throughout the seasons a variety of duels and a variety of ways of people, how people fight, whether they cheat, whether they, you know, whether it's very fast. It's I think they've done a very good job in bringing a bit of realism.
Speaking of Game of Thrones, one thing I was going to ask was how closely you've been following the show since you left, and what you're thinking, what do you think is going to be in the future since we're going now beyond the books?
Wow. Well, I mean, I love this show, and I watch it avidly. And every so often at a convention, you know, I'll pick people's brains and they will tell me things that they're not allowed to. But because I'm kind of bound by the GAT, you know, code of honor, we can trust each other. So
what do we say to the Twitter sphere? Not today.
But there's no doubt we do love to tease people about it, though. This, you know, but God, what's going to happen? It's anybody's guess.
What?
You know, we're going into unknown territory. We're going into a place which will infuriate people as much as it inspires them, because we are now in a place that no one knows about.
Yeah, and I was kind of wanted to ask a question about kind of the more about the weapons stuff, because I'm really curious if your recent research has delved into the more sci-fi aspects and how you would deal with a lightsaber.
Well, you know, all I can say is that I cannot even comment on what you're talking about.
Of course.
Yeah, we heard that was a, and if you'd like us to edit this out, that's fine. But I heard that you actually mentioned being a foreigner in Star Wars.
Oh God, yeah. It's so funny the things that people really pick up on, and you kind of forget about it when you're doing an interview, because you think you're just being very
real quick. Is this something you're comfortable talking about?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
I don't think this is a spoiler in any way whatsoever, or I don't think this breaks my confidentiality agreement.
Sure.
All I was saying is that I was an alien, but what I meant by that is that unless you're from Earth, you're gonna be an alien,
right?
Am I right?
You're very right.
Yeah, so that's what I meant, and I thought I was being really clever by kind of saying that. So I was like, wow, there's no flies on me. I can tell you I'm an alien, because surely nearly everyone in the Star Wars universe, unless you're from Earth, which I hear mentioned very, 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 like not at all, everyone's an alien. So, of course, they went, oh, my God, he's an alien. He's going to be an alien. And, of course, all I meant was that I was not from Earth.
Well, the audience in that respect has a degree of training from Star Trek, because Star Trek has – do you follow Star Trek?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Okay, so you know they have this, you know, pseudo-racist view that, you know, there are lots of humans that come from other planets, but unless you're a special forehead person who spent at least an hour in makeup, if that's the case, you're an alien. And they say it.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Well, yes, I had forgotten that, but yeah. That is brilliant.
Well, yeah. Let me ask you this then. Do you have a confidentiality agreement for Dark Continents?
No, I don't. I don't have that. And I can definitely talk about it, even though we haven't filmed it yet.
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to because it sounds really interesting. Johnny, have you heard anything about this?
I absolutely know nothing about it. The first I heard about it is it, well, we this today we were kind of rushed going into the show, just pull back the curtain a little bit. And so I wasn't completely prepared, but today was very chaotic. But so you basically told me about it. I have known nothing about it, and I'd love to hear more about this particular film.
I know nothing about it either. Let's ask the fresh maker.
Yes.
Sorry,
So,
Miltus.
Dark
I've been.
Coincidence. So, these guys who I think are pretty genius. Let me just. Here we are. Yeah, here we are. So, four countries, five films. Terror is a universal language. So, Two-Headed Snake Entertainment and Comet Films are basically, they've come up with this brilliant idea. It's kind of Lovecraftian, Clive Barker-esque, an anthology, a film anthology, which is asking directors from Norway, Belgium, Greece, and the UK to make five segments, five short stories, which will be filmed in those different countries in with five different stories, and then put together as a film. And obviously, those five stories will have a through line. And the through line, of course, is this thing, the pact that people make with the dark side, right? So my one is about a guy who basically is I think it's changed a little bit now, the script, but it's he's visiting a property that he's interested in buying. I think he might be a property developer, and he stays overnight in it. And it's not what I would say, you know, it's not about, because we know there's so many stories based on haunted houses, but it's the atmosphere that they're conveying and conjuring, which is so exciting and so rich. And you know, that whole thing of the Lovecraftian idea of kind of meeting something which is your deepest, darkest fear, which kind of comes from you but is manifested by whatever energy is out there, is what is something that is really exciting. And of course, you know, that's why filmmakers go back to it again and again and again, because it's you know, you can keep digging for gold. It's a very exciting thing. So that's my section. I don't know the other four, except that they equally deal with people facing their own demons. But I think it's a brilliant idea and a great, you know, concept to have people from different cultures making movies that will be put together. And the producers, Stewjopia, and Stuart Bedford, who are the writers, directors, and the producers of it, they're the guys who are kind of overseeing it and tying it all together.
I personally love projects like that. There's been a couple different movies I've seen that are similar to that.
Are you referring to the Look Who's Talking series?
Nope.
No?
Nope.
Okay. What are you talking about?
Well, the first one that came to mind is like Masters of Horror, which was I can't remember what channel it was on. It was either HBO or something like that, or Showtime. And it was just an hour. It's almost like old, like Crypt Keeper stuff. I don't know if you remember.
Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah, Tales from the Crypt. That's right. Yeah,
Ooh.
it was similar to that.
He scared me. Miltos.
It was similar to that. But what they did was they called Masters of Horror because they actually grabbed like different masters, like directors and stuff like that, and they would all make these 1 hour movies, and they would show them on this whatever channel it was. But some of my favorite horror movies came out of that collection, and it's. And of course, when it's a project like that, and you're only making 1 hour films, and the budget's not going to be, you know, out of this world. It's going to be a pretty small budget. You get a lot of creative and like pet projects and stuff that come out of these, like people things that these directors have been wanting to do for a long time. They finally get a chance to do it and explore it. And you mentioned something in the like the Cthulhu mythos kind of you know aspect. And there's actually one that was kind of taken into that realm as well. And there's all really interesting films. But there's all yeah. What else also came to mind is I know these. What is it? They did these like love stories, like they did that where they cut it up and like they had different directors for different sections of the movies.
Yeah,
I thought you that might, because didn't they do one set in Paris and then they did one, I think that was set in New York, I think, but they're two separate movies, but very similar concept.
That does ring a bell.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm not.
So I love that. I'm, you know, and I'm very much of the opinion that I mean, you know, I just love people who are making horror films and trying to create, you know, storytelling is, as far as I'm concerned, the best filmmakers come from the horror genre when it comes to storytelling. Do you know? What did I see recently which blew me away? It's not a very recent movie. It's called, oh my God, what's it called?
Is it a horror movie?
Yeah. I'm going to find it for you.
I'm going to guess he's going to use he used his celebrity status and he got a sneak peek at Goosebumps. Goosebumps. It's a popular. It was a popular
book series.
Yeah, American children's horror series of novels, and now they are banking on nostalgia to bring audiences in for a movie based upon it.
Yeah, it was R.L. Stine's big thing.
It was all very campy, but it was perfect. It was perfect for its time, and now they want to bring it back. And
yeah, I'm not super excited about it myself.
You don't want to see the Mummy Pumpkinhead's Revenge?
No, I don't.
It's his name is Mike Flanagan.
Mike Flanagan?
The guy who made Oculus, which I wasn't that into. I didn't find it that interesting. However, Absentia. Oh my God.
Absentia.
His first film. It was terrifying. I cannot say the word without feeling one of the things that, I mean, I have not seen something so affecting in a long, long time, and I watch a lot of horror films. I think it was it's a work of amazing accomplishment, and it really, really stays with you. And wow, I mean, that's all I can say. If you have not seen it, you have to see it.
I have not. I just quickly looked it up here, and it looks like it got a bunch of awards, and it came out in 2011.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, and it looks interesting. It actually really does.
It's really good.
What would you say it is that brings you back to the horror genre? Because lately, I've become more interested in it, but I get interested in actually online videos because I feel like when I'm watching a movie, there's a little bit of a disconnect where I know I'm watching something that was designed by somebody else to scare me. And it's not that online videos aren't like that. It's just that there's a degree of plausibility because it's some other person independently out there showing you something.
In contrast to what?
In contrast to movies where you know it's a production and it's easy to not suspend your disbelief. So, Miltos, what is it that draws you to the horror genre specifically?
I mean, just to answer your question directly, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. I'm kind of constantly disappointed with horror films. But that doesn't mean that there hasn't been some amazing ones made, and there continues to be amazing ones made. But sometimes you just come across them by accident. Like Absentia, I came across by accident, and I saw it last year. I didn't see it and didn't even hear about it. I haven't even heard of Mike Flanagan. But what's brilliant about the film and the reason why it works is all those things you just said, you do not think them for 1 second. There's something so matter-of-fact about it, something so not showy. Everything that you like about watching something that's just been made by an amateur, where you don't really know what you're watching, all of those things he manages to get, he gets it completely. So you just see these two sisters just meeting again after a long time. He shows you that there's been stuff that's happened between them, that they haven't seen each other, that there's been some kind of trauma, all the kind of typical things. But the things that he's what the story is about is not, that's not as important as the way he makes you experience it. And that is why it works. And that's why any film works, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, it's a really controversial film in the sense that you only have to say the title and people have an immediate reaction to it. But watching the original, it's very, very visceral. You know, yes. And even if you watch it again and again, even watching it now, it doesn't lose that power it has, even though it looks damn cheap, and you know it's Tobe Hooper, isn't it, what he was doing when he was making that film. He was literally shooting it from the hip, but it's incredibly visceral. It's crazy, but it captures something very, very important, and that is why I always come back to the horror genre, because I think if you can make a good horror film, if you know how to shoot a scene that builds tension and dread and that kind of horrible feeling of anxiety in an audience member's stomach, you can pretty much make anything you like. You can make rom-coms. You can make even a movie with Adam Sandler and make it funny. You can do whatever you like, because I think if you can do that, then that's where you cut your teeth as a creative person. And that is why I think you always see some amazing gems pop up from time to time. There's a lot of crap out there. Let's not beat around the bush.
Yeah.
But for every 100 films, there will be one that makes all of those worthwhile.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that. I never really thought of it that way, because I've known a lot of amateur filmmakers, and horror seems to be their go-to genre. It's not the thing that they build up to. It's the thing that they want to go to immediately. And I think the perception, at least in the circles that I've been in previously, is that it's one of the easier ones, because you get a monster and people screaming, throw some dark lighting in there, and you've got a movie.
Yeah, it's not most of the time. It's not deeply complicated.
Yeah, but it is. The thing is, it you can make it like that.
Yeah.
You can absolutely make films like that. And that is why people do. They get, because they go, well, that's it. But when you take that monster away, and when you take away the dark lighting, if you can't shoot someone's face and make me believe something that is not real, then you can't do it. Right. But if you can, you can. And so it's easy to shoot a romantic comedy. You know, a boy and a girl, you make them pretty enough and young enough, you know, you kind of, that's half the job done, right?
Yeah.
But to make a movie that is supposed to kind of conjure some kind of anxiety in an audience, because ultimately that's what it's doing. We're not talking about shocks. We're not talking about people's heads coming off. It's about the other things. Like, you could list a whole load of Cronenberg movies, and they're very visceral, and there are some shocking things in them, but you can remove all of those scenes and there will still be, and I challenge anyone to take all of those scenes out that are kind of either special effects laden or visceral, and you will still have a movie that has some kind of edge to it, has a kind of, whether it's the soundtrack, whether it's just how the camera moves, all of those things that sometimes, it's like a photographer. There are some photographers who've just got an eye, and they just can see composition in a way that you and me just don't see it. So when they look at the same view, they see it in a completely different way. And they can take a picture of something you're looking at and make you see something different. And that is what a good film director does. And the best do it in horror.
And I completely agree with you. I actually scare very easily. I just want to throw that out there. So I actually have a love-hate relationship with horror because I have an appreciation for it, kind of like you do. I love the more psychological horror. I love them to really put me on edge, you know, for that entire hour and a half or whatever it is. I guess my comment earlier is that unfortunately we see too many try to take the shortcut. But yeah, you're right though. It's an art form for sure. It can be. Something I like to clarify for people, because you brought up Texas Chainsaw Massacre earlier. People like to say that that's based on a true story, and it is very loosely based on a true story.
It's loosely based on four true stories.
Right, but the one they reference the most is Ed Gein. And he was not in it. I like to tell people he was not from Texas. he actually lived in Wisconsin. So that's where the crazy people are. The crazy serial killers.
Got buddies in Wisconsin.
we do.
We love you, G2B.
Yeah.
We're not totally convinced you're gonna wear our faces.
Right. Making skin suits out of us. All right.
Now, I think this is actually a pretty natural segue, especially talking about, you know, amateur and sometimes less, not that we reference it a lot, but horror that's of a lesser quality. And sometimes the cheap way out is just, hey, make it a comedy. Go splatstick with it. And one legend of splatstick is going to be joining us as a series on Stars soon.
Oh, right.
And that's Ash versus the Evil Dead.
Oh, my God. I am so excited about this.
Yeah, so you were a fan of the original series?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really, really excited about it. I mean, I like Bruce Campbell anyway, just as a person. He's, you know, a legend in his own right. And when I was a teenager, when I saw The Evil Dead, it's a really ridiculous thing to think about it now. I mean, I watched it when I was far too young, but it was an amazing bit of filmmaking from a 19-year-old. You know, that's the kind of stuff that inspires people to do it yourself. You know, And can you believe it that was banned in the UK for so many years? It was termed a video nasty, and it was literally banned. You could not get it in the country.
I did not hear that. I had no idea that was the thing.
Hold on. Is video nasty a parliamentary term? Like they slap that on the boxes?
Video nasty.
was it the scene with the young lady in the tree?
Oh, just... my God, that's probably the thing that swung it. Yeah,
that's interesting, because now that I've become a little older and I have a bit more of a worldly view, not that I leave the country very often, but it seems to me that there's so much about America that is very, very puritanical still. And so that's surprising to me. Is it very still puritanical in the UK about certain things like that?
No, we've become much more relaxed now about these things.
Okay.
Yeah, one country that isn't very relaxed anymore is Australia, apparently. They've been banning video games. They've actually banned like 200 different video games over the last month or two.
Wow.
Yeah, which is really surprising. I find it interesting that the different standards across the world, because it can vary so greatly.
So true. I mean, it's crazy.
So when did you first see The Evil Dead, since it was declared video nasty so early on?
When did they make it? Do you remember?
Was it 80?
Did you use your powers on the internet to find out for me?
Yes, I can absolutely do that.
I'm gonna give a guess here. I'm gonna guess 81.
Okay, let's see if you're right. Do you want to take a guess, Miltos?
No.
Okay.
Although it does feel very, very right.
All right. Evil Dead. Let's see if I can find it on.
I mean, it definitely feels... Well, then again, I look at some of the shots and I think of the technology exactly where it was. And my easiest touchstone for the era is Rocky Horror. So I'm always comparing like what the technology looks like. But apparently Johnny already has our answer.
I do. Okay. And your guess was 1981?
Correct.
Oh.
That is the exact date. That is the year.
What?
Yeah, 1981.
Amazing. Amazing. So I saw it in that year, and I was like, I was a very young kid because I used to know the guy in the video shop, and I was like, you know, he knew that I liked horror films. I saw around the same time there was American Werewolf in London. That was another one I watched. So I think when I was watching those films, and this is the reason why I got really into special effects makeup, I saw those films as for what they were. Even as a young child, I could see those films and I was slightly detached from them, and I could see the slapstick of them. You know, I got the black humor of them. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even as a child, I got it. I was like, oh, this is kind of horrifying and funny. And I got that. And it gave me enough detachment that it didn't traumatize me. And I genuinely enjoyed watching them. But yeah, I had forgotten that thing about the tree. That's what you do when you're a young kid. You see, you block that stuff out.
Yeah, right.
Because you don't understand it.
Sure.
That's true. Now, Evil Dead, that's my experience with the tree scene is something that I just know because it's, you know, it's legendary now. Mm. But in the original series, the only one that I have seen all the way through is actually Army of Darkness.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I think actually that's true for me too. But I'm less like, I guess, you the two of you, because that's not my genre.
Horror?
Not just horror, but kind of that kind of horror.
Splatstick?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we need to have a marathon of Peter Jackson's early work.
Oh my God.
Is that because it's all Muppets?
No, it's all splatstick.
Oh, okay.
He made his name making independent splatstick.
Okay, I didn't know that.
It's so extreme, though, that you can't take it seriously. It's quite extreme, isn't it?
Yeah, it's literally like, you know, the Looney Tunes. I'm running so fast that before I get any traction, my feet have moved like 10 times.
Yeah.
That happens to characters, but because there's blood on the tile.
Oh, okay.
So it's literally a good Which 3 is, seconds.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Wow.
And Bad Taste.
Bad Taste, yeah.
Bad Taste was one of his early films, and what I remember best about it was how it started. Like, as soon as there was some sort of problem and there was this shadow government organization, it was like, we've got a problem now, let's call in the boys. And the boys is on speed dial.
Like, kind of like the bat phone type of thing.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
So do you think you're going to approach Stars to try to become part of Ash versus the Evil Dead? I'm sure they'd love to have it.
Oh my God, I would so love that. I would love that more than anything. If you're listening out there, I need to do something with that. Or The Walking Dead. My problem is with those two shows, of course, is simply my visa. That's the main thing when it comes to making stuff in the UK, in America for me.
Really?
Yeah, I can get it, but it's you know, you have to kind of it is still an issue. I mean, a lot of people do, of course, is that they're doing something, they get invited to you know, you get sponsored. That all of those opportunities have been there for me, and you know, I'm still, you know, I kind of think about it all the time. I think about having the option. The other thing, of course, is that when I was in LA and I did meet quite a lot of casting directors and producers, of course they all said, well, it doesn't really matter anymore because we don't make anything in America anymore. Making everything in Canada or Europe, you know, that
yeah.
So it doesn't matter, you don't need it. So there's that other thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny you say that because I know a lot of the Walking Dead actors are English.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which is interesting.
But it's made in the States, so
right.
you're subject to kind of visa regulations. So all of those, you know, like Andrew Lincoln, they've all got green cards, so you know, it's different for them.
Right.
I think I've actually shared this on the show before, but talking about Talking about filming abroad, are you familiar with Walker, Texas Ranger?
Yes, I am. Yes.
All filmed in Canada.
Was
Wow.
it
They didn't even bother taking the Ontario plates off of the Walker Mobile.
I did not know that.
That's
That is
true.
amazing. That is amazing.
Well, it's like you either go to Texas where everyone's going to be miserable because it's hot. It's
Yes.
just warm here.
Yeah.
Because we don't have the same Actors Guild. The Actors Guild doesn't have a real foothold in the state here.
Really?
Yeah. So we're kind of like this third coast where lots of people go to make stuff because you can get you can get actors outside the unions pretty easily.
Wow,
So you
yep.
said in Texas, is it?
Yes.
I know Austin. Yeah, Austin was a big film city, but recently I actually have a friend who works in that industry part time, and he was basically all pissed off because the tax breaks that people were getting, that when they came in and filmed the studios and all that, they would get tax breaks for doing it in Austin, but they put an end to that. So now people are going to New Orleans more often, or Atlanta,
Right,
or where
yeah.
else. Yeah, so politics has its hand in everything. So.
On a brighter note, Miltos, I mean, everybody knows at this point. Well, they'll know after they read the stuff that goes on to the onto the Facebook page and everything that you're at Space City. Well, that's not how they get their news. Everybody knows that you're going to be at Space City Comic Con. What are your plans for the con?
Well, it's going to be. I have to say, about 2 years ago, I never thought I'd ever go to Texas, and now I go. This is going to be my fourth trip there, and I love it there. I love, you know, what I'm disappointed is that I never get to go to Austin. I've got a lot of friends in Austin, and I've heard it's an amazing city. But I love Texas, and I'm really looking forward to going to the con. And I'm excited because there's going to be some great people there at the con who I'm looking forward to seeing, catching up with, and meeting for the first time. And I'm going to be doing the thing that I do now, which is I'm going to be doing water dance classes. And I kind of have these classes, and it's the maximum of 30 people. And I get people to fight with each other, and I kind of teach them their own style of dancing. Like everyone has their own particular way of fighting, and so I kind of try and get them, instead of getting them to be a certain way, I get them to do what is the most natural thing, and then I kind of teach them that it doesn't matter whether you're big or tall or small and slight.
Good or bad, or you're happy or sad.
Yeah,
Sorry.
and also that experienced, not experienced, that everyone brings something to the table when it comes to a duel. And for about 90 minutes I put them through their paces, and we have the Purple Hearts Armory and Dachau, who is who runs is actually the real deal, who actually runs a martial arts sword fighting class in Houston, and it's amazing because he kind of helps me with the classes because he actually knows his stuff. Whereas I kind of understand it from a creative point of view, he actually understands that technique in a very profound way, and so he helps me with the class, and it's great because every time I do a class, he gets kind of like new people signing up for his school, and so it's great. And you're going to have Purple Hearts Armory there, who are going to be selling those amazing wooden swords, which they actually made and designed for the TV show itself. So they were the guys who created my wooden sword.
Very cool.
Really?
And they're going to be selling those things at the con, and they're it's in a beautiful, beautiful piece of kit. They make them so beautifully. They're heavy, they're inscribed as well, but they literally are they're exactly the sword that I used in the show.
One thing I was going to bring up, you mentioned that 2 years ago was your, I guess, your first time in Houston. We actually met you about 2 years ago at Comic Palooza.
Yeah.
And we were actually a part of the group, the Space City Nerd. We're kind of married in this podcasting network thing.
It's polygamous since.
That's what?
Nothing.
No. Okay.
Go on.
anyway, so I wanted to bring that up because you actually helped us. You went to Neil's bar with us.
Yeah.
And you helped us judge a costume contest.
That's right. Yes.
Yes.
I remember that very vividly. Yeah.
Yeah. It was. You were great. I wanted to thank you for doing that. And I don't know if you remember exactly everything that happened that night, but I offered you some of the beer that actually I had made, which you politely said no to, which is fine. I was just trying to jog your memory if you remembered who that was or anything like that.
I do remember all of this. That's amazing that you are actually, now you've said that the competition, I remember it now very vividly that night. And I do not mix my drinks. And yeah. Not because I'm some kind of prude, but if I do, I'm like a gremlin when you put them near water. I become the last person you want to be partying with.
It's great that you have that self-control, really.
Also, I'm sure a part of it was this 6-foot man with a Mennonite beard came up to you. He's like, would you like to try some Tentacle Kitty?
Which was the name of one of the beers, you're right. Yeah. Absolutely, that would have been awkward. Anyway, but yeah, we're glad that you're coming back to Houston, and
I'm looking forward to it. It's
yeah,
not a long way, is it?
Second,
it's not far away.
Not at all. No, I think it's just 2 or 3 weeks away.
Two
weeks. It's gonna be a fun con for sure. Is there anybody at the con that you know is gonna also be there that is maybe a celebrity to you that maybe you have not met that you would love to talk to?
I'm sure there is. In fact, I was looking at the website the other day, and I was looking at the people that were coming, and there was someone that popped into my head. Of course, right now I can never remember. But I'll tell you who I really like. Oh, Kate Mulgrew, of course.
That I want to see.
Has she cancelled already?
No. Zach was getting excited because his
my girlfriend.
Yeah, your girlfriend.
Captain J.
Yeah, I was going to say fiance, but I was like, I don't even know if that's a real thing. No, your girlfriend, yeah. She's super excited about meeting her.
Yeah, Kate Mulgrew is her captain.
I love her. She was what got me into the whole... That's when I really started enjoying Star Trek, when I was watching Voyager, and she was amazing.
That's so interesting, because like... Captain J was the one who introduced me to Voyager, and what I loved about it so much was that it had a point. They were on a specific mission to go. They had to get home, and it is, it's like a, what's the opposite of a favorite? What's the one word, the not favorite?
You're, I don't know.
People dislike it a lot, and I don't know why.
Yeah, they're sexist.
It's funny. I don't know why they would. Do that. Who knows? You know, it always surprises me. You know, there's a huge, people get really protective over the thing that they love doing, you know, the thing that they love the most, whether it would be Star Trek or Star Wars. There's a whole rivalry there in itself, because
right.
One believes that one is incredibly is intellectually superior to the other.
Yeah, I think it's something. Sometimes just people just love something that much that they don't want it to change. You see that all the time now. Now, you know, in stuff like where Johnny Storm now in the Fantastic Four is going to be black, which normally he's not. So people get really worked up about that. I think it's the same type of thing. Like people get attached to Picard or Kirk or whoever, and they're all male. So like, the same type of thing. I, it's just people. They don't know when to let go. I guess.
No.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about. Talking about the intellectual argument was that there were lots of people who were upset with the J.J. Abrams Star Trek because it didn't match the tone,
right?
Where everything was in Star Trek, everything's a philosophical debate, and you know what is the nature of omnipotence,
right?
And in the Abrams movies, it's
action, out the wazoo,
Yeah, that is, I kind of agree with them. I think that is true. I think that is the thing that you get from his in you know his version of events, you know. But the one thing that is lacking is the philosophical, the epicness. I think the epicness is what is not there. But it means that he's a much better person for Star Wars than he is for Star Trek, because with Star Wars has that kind of it's kind of fantasy. It's not science fiction. I always think that about Star Wars. It's fantasy, you know. It's virtually begins with once upon a time,
yeah.
You know, and I think J.J. Abrams is much better suited to create stories like that, that have kind of rhythm and movement and spectacle and the kind of the arc of something which is yeah, much more fantasy. But yeah, with I don't think he really got to grips with the thing about Star Trek. It's got to be about science and art and the kind of big debate about, is God dead?
Yeah, which is absolutely crazy when you really think about it, how crazy it is that he's doing both.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I don't know how that happened. I don't know how that happened. The man is a powerhouse. I've never seen anyone with so much enthusiasm and energy. I mean, he just is always on, always excited, always, you know, pulling everyone along with him. It's an amazing thing to see. Amazing.
So, would you say, and if you're allowed to talk about it, what is the without giving any details of the movie, what is the overall J.J. Abrams experience, apart from his enthusiasm, as far as working with him?
It's just one of those things that you get you get to see someone who has that amount of passion and that amount of enthusiasm, and who can orchestrate huge amounts of people. Not just the cast and the extras, but the crew and the whole machine of creating things that actually exist. The reality of every situation, the sets that were created, the choreography of just keeping things going. You know, there'll be times when you're shooting a scene and you're waiting and waiting for it to, you know, the precision, you know, because it's a technical feat. Mm-hmm. All filmmaking is a technical feat. That's what kind of makes it so damn dull for the actors sometimes, because it's so technical.
Yeah, speaking about the technicality, he just, I think yesterday or today, I think it was yesterday, last night, did a presentation at San Diego Comic-Con where they had this footage, and basically it was kind of showing off the fact that they're doing stuff with less of the CGI and all that kind of, like CG, and they're doing more of the real effects, you know, kind of like with the soccer ball droid. They're actually building these sets. They're building a Millennium Falcon to do stuff in. I found that really interesting, and I was wondering if that if that adds a lot more complication that you saw, at least. I don't know. It seems like it'd be a lot harder, but
it does to the crew because. Yeah. Your, you know, all of those things have to be constructed, and then when you've got something like the Millennium Falcon, you have to construct it in such a way so that you can open it all out, so you can get your cranes in and your cameras in there, and you know, so people can move around in it, because actually it's quite claustrophobic, but it's impossible to film in. But of course, because they've created it, they've built it, it means that they can do whatever. They can pull it apart, put it together in different pieces to suit them. So that's very, very useful. As far as the actors are concerned, when you have something that is actually tangible, it makes it so much easier.
Sure.
Because you don't have to act. You don't have to worry where your eye line is. You don't have to kind of go, oh, you know that thing, you have to look at that dot. Just keep your focus on that dot, because that's where that thing is. So you don't have to do it, because the thing is there, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And when you have to open a door, the door is there, you can open it. And so it creates... I keep using this word again, but it's kind of what I think is really important, this visceral quality. It means that everything is tangible, everything feel. So when an actor can feel something, react to something, and interact with their environment, it means that there is like resistance, like action reaction is happening. And even though it's happening on a subconscious level, because we can all use our imagination, it means that other things are happening. And when you watch it as an audience member, you see it. You know, you can't tell that it's there, but you know it is. You know there's something like real that you can kind of bite down on. And I think that makes a difference. I think it makes it more moving. And I think the thing that even though the story of the first three films of the Star Wars, epic story, even though those stories were actually filled with amazing drama and amazing moments of incredible darkness and drama, it never came across in the film.
You think because of the green screen?
Not because of the green screen, but the green screen was like a symptom of everything else. It's like you have to, the only thing that's important is the story, nothing else. The story is the most important thing. The dynamics of those characters and their relationships is the most important thing. The reasons why we remember Star Wars and the reason why we enjoy it so much is because we love the fact that you had this young boy, Luke Skywalker, who was completely lost, who had terrible tragedy. You witnessed the tragedy happen to him in front of your eyes, and who meets a space pirate who doesn't give a shit about anything and is a mercenary. And those two have to get on. And then they meet a wisecracking, smart-ass, badass princess. Like, those three together, that is the film.
When you describe it that way, like, I'm totally in the fantasy camp now.
But that is the film lives and breathes through their dynamic. And that is why it's so fantastic. That is why when they fall in love, it means something. That is why when Han Solo gets frozen in carbonite, it means something. These things matter. And if they don't matter, then it doesn't matter about anything else. And that is what you get when you concentrate more on the story, more on the characters, and more on the actors than you do on how beautiful everything looks. And, you know, storytelling has to be simple. You know, you can complicate it as much as you like, but that is why I believe Star Wars is much more fantasy than science fiction.
I don't know how you... Well, I could go back and listen to the recording of how you did it, but you managed to get me twice as excited about Star Wars with Star Wars 7 with absolutely no spoilers. So, achievement unlocked.
I have learned to do it since the summer. I'm not being allowed to say anything, but yeah, and for all of those reasons, that's why it's going to be exciting.
That's very cool. Hey, I wanted to think, it looks like we're not going to get to our top three, bottom three.
You got to.
We've got to?
You have to.
Okay, then we're going to, okay, then we're going
to. You can cut it out if you don't have time. Well, you might as well talk about it.
Well, I don't want to take up too much of yours because you said you had a specific.
I know, but we might as well do that because I've got an absolute corker for you.
Let's do it.
Okay, we'll do a lightning round. Okay, where generally speaking, we spend a lot of time like degrading one another for what we've chosen. So,
well, we can go through ours, me and Zach's, pretty quick because I'm really curious about what you have, and you can spend as much time on yours as you like.
Right.
Okay.
I wrote nothing down. And,
you never do.
Which one are you more excited about, Miltos? The top three or the bottom three?
Oh, well, the bottom three, because the top three kind of always. I mean, I reckon we will agree upon our top three, but the bottom three is what I'm intrigued about. I don't have. I've got one scene. I've got one scene, which I found, which is Deathstalker 3. And it is probably the worst sword fight I have ever seen in my life. You've got to Google it. I think if you just put in worst sword fights in cinema history, it will always come up. It is absolutely brilliantly bad.
Is it a foreign? Foreign's relative here. Is it? Was it a Hong Kong?
I don't know. I don't think it's even that. Well, let me just kind of put it.
Zach, while he's doing that, do you want to go ahead and go through yours? Do the top. Yeah. Let's do the top real quick.
Huh? The top. Okay. Let's see. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2: Combat Cold Cuts. When Michelangelo starts beating up people with sausages that he found in some sort of odd underground mall. Then number two is definitely going to be Kung Fu Hustle, The Battle of Three Masters.
Okay.
Yeah. Where the first time Donut, Cooley, and Taylor reveal that they're masters and they take on the Axe Gang by themselves.
Okay.
And certainly not least, what I have to say is probably the brightest point in the Star Wars prequels, and that's Anakin versus Obi-Wan.
Anakin what?
Anakin versus Obi-Wan.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Absolutely. That's good. Yeah. My top.
Although I would still say that it was the Darth Maul and Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan one. Because I was so excited by that. But anyway, also because of its outcome.
That one was beautiful. But
yes, right.
But what I liked about the original what I like about the last fight in the prequels is once again going back to this world of this word visceral. There was something about the way that Hayden Christensen and Ewan McGregor actually connected in that fight that made it feel heavy and sweaty and real. That's it.
The tagline for this episode is the Visceral Podcast.
There we go.
Yes. That's a very good way of putting it. Yeah, I think that's good. I agree.
So my top three, I'll go through them real quick. This one, that my number three, is actually really personal to me because it's a movie I've seen 1,000 times growing up, and that's the movie Willow. And I was going I was going to put the last fight in the movie on it because it's like two fights going on at the same time. It's like the one at the top of the castle. They're trying to sacrifice the baby, blah, blah, blah. All that's going on. But actually, I was remembering the fight that I remember more fondly is actually about halfway through the movie when Mad Mardigan is fighting on a wagon defending Willow and the baby. And all these guys are riding up on horses. They're fighting them. They get knocked off. It's a very action-packed fight scene, and I really like it. Number two is actually Rocky versus Apollo Creed in the first Rocky.
Wow.
And I'm going with that one because I recently learned, I didn't know this before, but Sylvester Stallone was adamant that they were throwing that he needed to throw real punches and actually connect with each other. And I believe he actually ended up in the hospital because he got hit so hard in the jaw. And so I like that one because of the backstory and how real he wanted that to be. Number one, I went ahead and went with Luke versus Vader in episode 6.
In 6? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, was that fight particularly long?
No, it wasn't.
Okay. I didn't think it was.
It wasn't, but it meant a lot because it was the end of these three movies, and it meant a lot to Luke, and it meant a lot to Vader. It was very important. Yeah. And I think that's why I chose it, cuz I got Star Wars in the brain since we're all anticipating episode 7, so it's something that I just can't get out of my mind. But that's my top three.
Miltos.
My top three are Princess Bride with Carrie Ells and Mandy Patinkin.
Yeah.
Just because it's just classic. All my fights are sword fights. Because it's just brilliant, and it really has a real feel for the Errol Flynn. You know, it has that kind of. They really managed to capture that, the essence of what those films are like when you were watching those dudes doing it back in the 30s. So that was one. My second one would be Uma Thurman in Kill Bill 1.
Oh, yeah.
Where she faces off against all the masked guys of Lucy Liu's kind of tribe, like endless amounts of, just because it's just so, it, well, just because it's style over substance, really. But it always gets me every time I watch it. It's just thrilling. And again, Quentin Tarantino, like both those films are like homages. And again, Kill Bill is an homage to that genre of Hong Kong filmmaking. So that was exciting.
Absolutely.
And then number three is, I think, it's a tough one, really, to be honest. I think it's a, it could be, something like anything from the whole film of
Kung Fu Hustle.
No, not Kung Fu Hustle.
Little Shop of Hearts.
It's a Japanese movie, and it's the Zatoichi, 2003. Zatoichi with Takeshi Kitano. Really, really, really good.
Excellent.
I've never heard of that. I'll have to look it up.
You've got to watch it. It's very stylish. It's all about the blind swordsman Zatoichi, and who basically is this old man, but kind of rescues this village from this horrible kind of bandit. And it's just brilliant. You've got to watch it. It's, if you like a certain kind of swordplay, like that covers everything. That covers the elegance of the rapier and the blade. And then it covers the, you know, obviously the kind of Hong Kong kind of martial arts thing. And then you have the simplicity of the samurai and how a samurai sword, a katana, is used like so efficiently, one blow and people are just cut in half, you know, that kind of thing. So so those are my top three.
I just had a moment because I realized that I left one out that I really should have had on my list, and I know Zach agrees with me. One of the best fight scenes of in recent memory was the Daredevil, the new show on Netflix. It's like a second or third episode. There's like just a constant shot of this hallway, and Daredevil's just bouncing around doing all these flips and all kinds of crazy stuff, and it's one of the best fight scenes I've ever seen.
Really?
Yes, it's
my
so
God, I've got to see it. So is this a good this series?
Oh, it's very good. And if you like the fight scenes, then you'll definitely love this.
Okay, I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, you need to.
The cool thing about that one is that it is extremely personal. That fight scene tells a good story because it's immediately after he's had a great deal of distress. He was comatose for hours on end, and then he still goes and does his mission. And you can see all that. It's almost like he's the actor's secret. Although the audience already knows the secret, but he leaves that distress in his fighting style very, very well. And so it's very moving.
Yeah.
We're on bottoms?
Yes.
Bottoms.
Go, Zach.
Okay. Number three, I am going to go with The Cave Troll from Fellowship of the Ring.
Okay.
My taste for fighting is that you have to show me a wide angle so I know what's going on.
Right. That one kind of used some camera tricks and stuff to make it, I think, easier on them.
I think Peter Jackson was going for, you know, feeling the fog of war.
Sure.
And so everything's very close, and it's a lot of shoulder shots, and as a result, it messes with your head a little bit. Number two. I'm going to have to go with, I'm going to have to go with Indy shot first. When Indiana Jones shoots the swordsman.
Yeah.
Like, it's a fun idea, but I'm so saturated by it now. I've heard the story over and over
of
and over
why
again.
It happened. Yeah.
I'm tired of hearing the story.
Sure.
Yeah. And the last one, this is extra points if you guys know what I'm talking about. There was a very, very, very low-budget independent film made in the early 2000s that was made in the style of a blaxploitation film.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, we're far out of the 70s at this point, so it's not actually it's not an actual movement in cinema anymore. And it was called Black Ninja.
Okay.
And Black Ninja featured some okay fight scenes, but the catharsis at the end of the last fight is that he gets the bad guy cornered, and that's when you learn that he can use his acupuncture skills to not only paralyze you permanently, but also give you permanent diarrhea.
Oh, Jesus. All right.
Amazing.
That one almost made my top, but no.
So my list is, I only got two on my list. I only had one going into this, and I just remembered another one that kind of bothered me. And that one was actually it's from the movie called Kiss of the Dragon, and the fight scene at the end of the movie is where he performs the Kiss of the Dragon. I think this is a Jet Li movie, I think. And the Kiss of the Dragon was, he did a certain series of moves, kind of like acupuncture type stuff, like you were talking about.
Like the 5-point exploding heart technique?
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
Basically, his body froze the enemy who he was fighting. He did all this combination of button presses on his chest, and he froze, and it's supposed to like make his heart explode, and he's paralyzed, and he can't move, but he feels all this pain and dies, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
But I think it's just a little bit ridiculous. Because especially since the rest of the movie, we had a bunch of awesome fight scenes. It's that fight scene that bothered me. All right. Now, this one I brought up to Zach. I mentioned it earlier because I was trying to make this list. And I didn't like the Dark Knight Rises fight scene near the end when Bane fights Batman.
And that was on my list, too.
Yeah, it's part... And for me, the fight itself wasn't very good, but what really bothered me the most out of that entire fight was all the extras in the background. And if you try to watch them during the fight, they're throwing, like, these huge whiffs, and it's just not choreographed well. They didn't get trained fighters. They didn't get people that knew how to, you know, throw punches and make it look like it hit. It all looked like the worst staged fighting I've ever seen. And it's so hard for me to focus on. Yeah.
I can't believe you mentioned that, because that is definitely what I was going to say. I was so disappointed. I was like, really? Is this it? The end of the trilogy comes to this?
Yes, I had the same thought.
Wow.
And it really bothered me because I'm such a huge Batman fan. I was
a big fan of those movies. You know, I mean, I love those movies. I even love a lot of the Dark Knight
Rises.
Yeah. But that to me was unforgivable.
Well, so that's on your list.
A punch up?
that's awesome. That was all on your list. So that where did that one fall on your worst list?
That was a number two. Okay. My number one was the Deathstalker. Deathstalker 3, which I try and find it on YouTube. It's definitely worth seeing. In fact, while we're here, I'm going to have to do this because it's just too good. You've got to watch it while I'm telling you about it.
Okay. Oh, so we're going to do a patented...
I've got it right here. Here it is.
Okay, so we...
Okay. And, there you go.
Guys, you'll have this link below, so you can go ahead and start it with us. We are going to go to 00, and we are going to start now.
So, and then there is one from Rashomon, which is one of the great...
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't it great?
Oh, no, it's got the candles.
I know.
He lost the candle.
It's getting intense.
They just need to kiss and get it over with. Look at that.
He should just lick his ear.
And it, no matter how many times I watch this, it never gets any less brilliant. Look at it. Where is he going?
Oh, who's this guy? Oh, that was great.
I don't need any others. I'm sorry. I don't need any others. That is all three. You can have all of that for all three.
That was great.
You're welcome.
Well, Miltos, thank you so much for coming out on the show. We really, really enjoyed having you. Everybody at home, don't forget that Miltos is going to be at Space City Comic Con. He is going to be doing water dancing workshops that is going to help you learn what your fighting style is. And obviously, if you're a fan of Game of Thrones, then you know he knows exactly what he's talking about, and he's going to make you a death machine.
Yeah, come sign up, come and do the classes.
Now, is it first come
you
first?
Get a certificate.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think I'm gonna do. I think I'm going to do like two on Saturday and two on Sunday. And if demand is huge, I'll throw in another one. I mean, you know, I'm very flexible. It all depends on whether people want to come and do it. If there's enough people, I'll put in another class. You know, I'm always willing to bend over backwards.
You were super flexible in your time in this podcast. We really appreciate that.
So it's first come, first serve. There's not going to be any pre-registration of any kind.
I think what happens is that I've spoken to George, the promoter, and he said that what you should be able to do, you should be able to go to the website and you should be able to book online.
Okay.
Okay. Is there any fee associated with it?
Yeah, it's going to cost you, but mainly because it's just an extra thing, and of course it takes up a lot of my time. But yeah, it will be. I'm not sure on what the pricing is going to be. It's going to be, I think, between last time I did it, I think it was like $35 or $40 per person. But you get a certificate, you get a signed photo, and basically for me. What I wanted to do something different from just kind of turning up at a table, buying a photograph and having a signature. So to me, I think this is like 90 minutes of kind of hands-on experience, which I think is kind of better.
That is a small price to pay for turning someone into a killing machine.
Better than getting a photo. And you get a photo as well. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. But I would please check online all about that, because I am still in the process of negotiating when the classes are going to be. But that should all be in hand within the next couple of days. But they are happening. There's going to be two on Saturday and two on Sunday. So you know, show your interest at least at the website, and we'll sort it out. And if the worst comes to the worst. There will be a times up table put up by the end of the week.
Very cool. Once again, thank you. Thank you so much. We look forward to seeing you at Space City Comic Con. And I guess it's time to say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody. And thanks, guys. I look forward to seeing you in Texas in a couple of weeks' time, all right?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Hey, you're live on World X Games.
Oh, God, stop doing that.
I'm sorry. I get excited. How's it going?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, you can.
Great.